My talk this morning has actually two titles. The first one is The Healing Power of the Mindful Heart. And the second title is actually a play on words, only you can only tell it's a play on words by seeing it in the written form, so I'll tell you and then I'll explain it. The second title is Metta is a Metta Practice. Metta is a Metta Practice. The first metta is M-E-T-T-A, which is the Pali word for loving kindness. The second metta is the English prefix meaning transcending or encompassing. So metta is a metta practice. The first thing I want to talk about has to do a little bit with translation. We talk a lot about mindfulness here. Everybody heard that word? mindfulness this, mindfulness that, and all kinds of mindfulness practices. Unfortunately, English is a little problematic, and that word is slightly problematic because the mind of mindfulness, the actual word for mindfulness is sati, but the mind that it's referring to is the word citta, and it doesn't translate actually as just mind. It really translates as heart-mind. That in the traditions that this comes from, that the heart and mind are considered one, the unit of our consciousness, you might say. We tend to split them, and so when we say mindfulness, people end up thinking about something around here instead of something around here. But so what that means is the word heartfulness would be as legitimate as the word mindfulness when we talk about our practice. And you might hear the word bodhicitta, and that means, bodhi is, of course, relates to the Buddha, and that means awakened heart-mind, which is what we're practicing to reveal, you might say. And another thing I often like to say, and some of you may have heard me talk about this or teach about this before, is that you often hear, particularly on retreats, Vipassana retreats, although you may hear it in daily life teachings as well, talking about the continuity, keeping up a continuity of mindfulness, that we want a continuity of mindfulness as we practice. So when we're on retreat, it's maintaining the mindfulness through the walking, the sitting, the eating, and even in daily life, that is sort of the aspiration, to remain mindful and present throughout everything that we do. But in the light of what I just said, we could also think of it as a continuity of kindness, that we're practicing a continuity of kindness. And often I like to remind myself of that because that has a whole different tone to it, a whole different feeling to it. And then just like what we think of traditional mindfulness, you know, we lose it, we get lost, we forget, we get caught up in our stuff, and then, we come back. And just like we come back to the sensations of the moment, we come back to this, what I might call as a field of kindness. The Dalai Lama is well known for having said, "My religion is kindness." I mean, what does he mean by that? You know, one thing with kindness, we tend to think we're going to feel a particular way. Kindness is a certain feeling or emotion. And the interesting thing with the practice of metta, loving kindness, and compassion is it doesn't matter what you feel. It's really not about what you feel. It's really about the larger container, the space or the field in which you hold experience. I just came across a Rumi quote, which is, "There's no better love than love with no object." So we often think of love or kindness or compassion as being towards something, someone, some event. But it actually, in its pure form, it doesn't need an object. It exists without an object. Objects come up and then it's revealed in the light of metta or loving kindness and awareness. But it's there, that awareness and that kind of loving kindness and compassion is there whether there's an object or not. So we might think of it as, again, I often talk about resting in awareness, resting in presence, but we can also rest in kindness. It can be our kind of default setting. Kindness also has sort of an active side to it as well, which I'll say a little bit about. The kindness is an expression of our openness, the openness of practice. It's an expression of the letting go of resistance in practice. It's the expression of connectedness in practice. It's this expression of being with things as they are, the willingness to again and again be with things as they are. It's not about being nice. Sometimes people get nice and kindness and those things mixed up. I mean, it's okay to be nice, but being nice is really an idea or a plan of behavior or something like that. We're talking about something more metta, M-E-T-A, something more encompassing that encompasses when we're nice and when we're not nice, actually. It's more like an intention. It's again, the ground from which we respond. And you might say it's the shining the light or bringing, responding to whatever arises with a kind of care, a kind of well-wishing, a kind of love, and a compassion towards the suffering that arises, no matter what it is and where it arises. And the event is most often that arises is something, your own emotions, your own feelings, your own experience. It can be kind of extended outwardly as well, obviously, to other people. But in the very basic, most important practice form is how we hold ourselves with that, how we let ourselves rest in that kind of kindness. Now, we have a lot of different options about how we respond, choices, how we respond to our experience when it arises with indifference. We often do a lot of that with judgment, condemnation, holding experience at a distance, disdain, fear. I think probably judgment, indifference, and fear are the most common, not so helpful, shall we say, responses to experience. And I think we all know that, know them, are familiar with them. But what if instead you held all experience in your heart? And really, mindfulness, again, people can practice mindfulness in a kind of distant way. You know, I'll be mindful of that over there. It's not really my anger. It's not really, you know, something I want to actually feel, but I kind of know it's there and it's maybe in the next room. But instead, really mindfulness and, again, this the heartfulness of mindfulness means you bring it into your own heart. It's right there. You're right with it. This path that we're on is sometimes called a path of purification. So part of this we find as we work with kindness, as we work with our attention to our experience, we may go through very intense experiences at times. And because what's happening is we're getting in touch with all of who we are. We're getting in touch with all that we carry around. We're getting in touch with all the places that we've repressed and held and rejected and pushed away. And so as those, we begin to own those again in a sense, not owning the sense of grasping and holding on, but owning in terms of recognition and acknowledgement, it can be quite painful at times or quite, you know, a lot of emotion can come up. You know, particularly in that what I call the early stages of practice, which are the first, you know, 10 or 15 years. that's very common if you go on retreats. Any of you have gone on long retreats, particularly, I know some of you practice a long time. But, you know, again, particularly, although it can happen anytime, but particularly in the first number of years, you may have deep grief may come up, different emotions. And this is part of the purification, the part of letting it come and letting it go instead of all this shutting down and closing off and pushing away that we learn to do. So we learn to feel what we feel. What a revelation. We learn to let it all be revealed. To do this, we need to let go of who we think we should be, and we need to let go of what we think we should be feeling. I find that people on the spiritual path often get lots of ideas about how they should be feeling about everything and what their responses should be. So we're actually learning to reunite ourselves, welcome all parts of ourselves, get back into the totality of ourselves. And when we get more into that totality of just our kind of emotional, experiential self, then we're able to open up to the totality that goes beyond the self altogether. As I was writing this talk, I was reflecting a bit, just a few moments ago, I said we should need to let go of who we think we are, think we should be. And this whole idea of seeing how absurd it is and what funny primates we are, and that we have this ability to say that what is happening shouldn't be happening. And if you think about that, how absurd is that? What is happening is what is happening. What we're feeling is what we're feeling. What is arising is what is arising. And yet we can get into all kinds of stories and games as if our will, our agenda, our expectation is what should be happening. And part of this path is learning to let that go. It's really the burden of our illusions, our narcissism, and so forth. It's like if it's raining, it's cloudy. Oh, it shouldn't be cloudy. Well, that's a real recipe for suffering. So, we teach a lot here about, particularly beginning instructions, is about watching our breath. And then we also talk about watching other sensation or sound and so forth. I think sometimes people think that is the practice, and it's, that we're, somehow, well, let me put it this way. It's not about watching our breath. Watching our breath is an important aid on the path, but it's not about becoming good breath watchers. And that's what I think a lot of people who practice become really good breath watchers. But so what? That's actually not going to free you. What we learn to pay attention to our breath is a convenient way to become more concentrated, meaning that we're actually stay connected to the present and not lost in all our stuff in our head. We pay attention to the breath to help be more calmer and steadier. We pay attention to the breath as a way to practice, as our training wheels, to learn to experience, have experience without grasping and pushing it away. To just experience, and the breath is a simple place to start. To just let it be, to just have, we don't hold on to it, we don't push it away. And therefore it's the learning, the ability to be with every feeling, to be with every experience, to be with every thought, in every situation in the same way, open, responsive, but not reactive, free, present. And when we go on retreats, we can learn that to often a more heightened and deeper extent. I want to read something to you from the Dharma book, Eat, Pray, Love. How many people have read this? This is from the very end. I think from the second to last chapter, 107. I thought it was a very good description of what it means to actually bring our difficulties, our pain, our emotions into our heart. It's describing, she's been on a silent solo, this says it's the ninth day of a retreat on a remote island in Indonesia. So she's just been on her own practicing. And, I think it's a little bit more systematic and condensed and maybe idealized than the actual experience. It is at times, but I think it's a beautiful poetic description, so I'm going to read it to you. On my ninth day of silence, I went into meditation one evening on the beach as the sun was going down, and I didn't stand up again until midnight. Just a side comment, the sun sets around 6:30 there, so I'm talking about 6 hours worth of meditation, straight meditation. I remember thinking, "This is it, Liz." I said to my mind, "This is your chance. Show me everything that is causing you sorrow. Let me see it all. Don't hold anything back." One by one, the thoughts and memories of sadness raised their hands, stood up to identify themselves. I looked at each thought, at each unit of sorrow, and I acknowledged its existence and felt, without trying to protect myself from it, its horrible pain. And then I would tell the sorrow, "It's okay. I love you. I accept you. Come into my heart now. It's over." I would actually feel the sorrow as if it were a living thing, enter my heart as if it were an actual room. Then I would say, "Next." And the next bit of grief would surface. I would regard it, experience it, bless it, and invite it into my heart too. I did this with every sorrowful thought I'd ever had, reaching back into years of memory until nothing was left. Then I said to my mind, "Show me your anger now." One by one, my life's every incident of anger rose and made itself known. Every injustice, every betrayal, every loss, every rage. I saw them all, one by one. I acknowledged their existence. I felt each piece of anger completely. This is an important part of the purification and part of the mindfulness. I felt each piece of the anger completely as if it were happening for the first time, and then I would say, "Come into my heart now. You can rest there. It's safe now. It's over. I love you." This went on for hours, and I swung between these mighty poles of opposite feelings, experienced the anger thoroughly for one bone-rattling moment, and then experiencing a total coolness, as though the anger entered my heart as if through a door, laid itself down, curled up against its brothers, and gave up fighting. Then came the most difficult part. "Show me your shame." I asked my mind, "Dear God, the horrors that I saw then, a pitiful parade of all my failures, my lies, my selfishness, jealousy, arrogance. I didn't blink from any of it, though. Show me your worst," I said. When I tried to invite these units of shame into my heart, they each hesitated at the door, saying, "No, you don't want me in there. You don't know what I did." And I would say, "I do want you. Even you, I do. Even you are welcome here. It's okay. You are forgiven. You're a part of me. You can rest now. It's over." When all this was finished, I was empty. Nothing was fighting in my mind anymore. I looked into my heart at my own goodness, and I saw its capacity. I saw that my heart was not even nearly full, not even after having taken in and tended to all those calamitous urchins of sorrow and anger and shame. My heart could easily have received and given even more. Its love was infinite. And then a couple paragraphs later, she goes on to say, and I think this is important, "I also knew somehow that this respite of peace would be temporary. I knew that I had not yet finished for good, and that my anger, my sadness, and my shame would all creep back eventually, escaping my heart and occupying my head once more. I knew that I would have to keep dealing with these thoughts over and over again until I slowly and determinedly changed my whole life." So when we practice with right understanding and clarity and a kind of continuity, then there is this opportunity to bring it all back into our heart. So this is metta as the metta practice. Metta as the transcending, encompassing, holding container for all our experience. It's bigger than and more than whatever arises, whatever meets. So, as she described in this book, whatever our experience, our pain and our emotions, our thoughts, our worries, our anxieties, our judgments, our hateful thoughts, our angry thoughts, our selfish thoughts, our mistakes, our foibles, our foolishness, our humiliations, our bad habits, our blunders, the whole underbelly of our personality, can we bring it into our heart? And even when you feel like you can't stand loving kindness, you can't stand being the whole thought of compassion turns your stomach, then meet that with loving kindness and compassion. Just meet that as well. So we start where we are. We always start where we are, which is just here and just now. And maybe some of you are already thinking, oh, I can't do that, or I should do that, or that's too much work, or whatever. Whatever your thought is, bring a sense of kindness and openness and acceptance and fullness to it. And I want to say ultimately that it's not really, if you think it's work, then you may be a little bit misguided. It takes effort, but ultimately it is delightful. And I think that's partly what, when the Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness, he's referring to the peace and the wonder and the beauty and the freedom that comes with this kind of openness of heart. And you'll find that the world will respond to it. So I'm going to end with a poem. This is a poem by Derek Wolcott. You may know it. The time will come when, with elation, you will meet yourself arriving at the door in your own mirror, and each will smile at each other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. And you will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored, for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. So let's take a moment of quiet together, silence together, and then be a little bit of time for any questions or sharing or comments, and then we'll have announcements and end for the day. Questions or comments about either the talk or about your meditation practice, anything I said, or anything about Dharma, or any example or situation you might like to share that might be relevant to what I talked about. Yeah.
For me, this wanting things to be different than they are, or having an idea of how it should be, manifests often in the moment as hatred. I mean, I don't direct it out there and say, why is this happening to me or why is this person doing it? It's more like there's some weakness or failing in myself. But in the moment when I'm experiencing that, I don't know how to practice. I like how you put it, because maybe the most I can do in that moment is a sort of mental noting of what's going on, what I'm experiencing. But I like how you put it, sort of having a metta, an envelope of metta. And for me, the word that expresses that best is intention. And a long time ago, I was in some sort of workshop, and we were supposed to write down something that we trusted about ourselves. And all I could come up with was, I trust my deepest intention. But still, in those moments, I don't feel that. So I have to trust that there's something deeper than that. My feelings.
Yeah. I think, you know, what you said was, first it's the acknowledging it, that there's that hatred, that anger towards oneself arising. That is the first, that's the first step in giving a little space. And in that little bit of space of recognition, then it's to meet that also with a kind of acceptance. It's not to get rid of it. It's not to have an agenda, a new agenda. Again, it's just that. And a little bit by little bit, you can introduce it, just a glimmer.
Introduce.
A glimmer of that sense of bringing an acceptance, a kindness towards that. Maybe fleeting, or sometimes you experience it clearly and other times not at all. But that's why it's practice. But it does get stronger, and you're absolutely right. If the intention is there, it will feed that. And the practicing that you'll remember. All the practice is really a kind of remembering. It's a remembering to be here. And it's a remembering. I can respond to even that kindness, even that. This too. I often think of that. Either even this or this too. Because, you know, we say, I shouldn't be angry, I should be feeling nice and kind. But no, we bring the kindness to that feeling angry. It's always one step larger than whatever. So I know I have times I've gotten into my mind in this little, you know, kind of confusing, you know, I'm feeling this, well, I should be kind, you know, and then I feel rotten because I'm thinking I shouldn't be kind. And then this whole cascade goes, and then finally I go, I know how to be kind. Just, okay. I know that. Just do it. Just this too. Just that whole crazy 5 minutes of how I got myself in a knot. Just be kind with that too. So that's the moment when it kind of stops. The whole game just stops. And you're there. You're aware of it. And there's a sense of holding it with your heart. So, you know, there's also the formal practice of metta practice. Have you done the, I don't know anything about your practice, but have you done any of the formal metta and compassion practices?
I've just started recently in the last 3 weeks. It was suggested to me by a teacher that I visited.
That what?
It was suggested to me by a teacher that I visited about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, okay. And part of the purpose of that kind of practice is to help you remember, you know, it increases the intention in the memory.
It's something I begin my... Well, I used to start the day with basically Vipassana meditation, but now I begin it with the metta, verbalizing this intention, and I end the day that way also.
Yeah. Good. So that's
helpful.
And again, it's not a... This is not none of this is a fast food practice. In other words, it takes time. Yeah, so.
Well, like you said... When I just started that, like 2 weeks ago, there came a period of 4 days after I came back from visiting this teacher. Once I got back, I refused to do it. I was so locked into kind of my old way of feeling. I had no taste for compassion, but that passed and I began to do it.
Right. You can have compassion for not having compassion. You might have to do that a lot. It's a good place to start. I'll get back to you, Laura. So Nancy first, Becca.
That passage that you read out of Elizabeth Gilbert's book, I remember when I first read it, I was struck by it because it felt almost counterproductive in some of that. I don't know if you recommend that sort of power driving. You know, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to take care of all of these things that I feel bad about, you know, and I don't know, you know, sitting 6 hours in a row is not something that I could do and probably feel very good about myself afterwards. But I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of why I gave the caveat in the beginning, yeah. Because, you know, from reading your book, I don't sense her as all that much of a tough yogi, you know. So I suspect when it happened very naturally. Mm-hmm. And that will, if you're on a long retreat, sometimes that happens. You just sit down and you just sit, and it's not an effort, it's not a struggle, and you just sit for hours, pretty much. I don't necessarily recommend that or that to be an aspiration, but it does happen sometimes. But I don't think that has to happen for what I'm talking about to happen. And I also don't know, you know, I actually like to ask her sometime, you know, there, it sounded like to me in reading that she just opened herself up and directed her attention and it came. We're more than a kind of, I'm going to pull it out, which is kind of what we have a, because of the way our culture is, you know. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to get it. Right. I tend to think, she was in a place where she could just direct her attention and it would come and it would come. And it, so that's, again, if that happens, that's more of a natural, I would say, again, a natural allowing. So overall, I wouldn't recommend a particularly powerhouse approach to it. It's more of a, when it comes, be there for it. You know, when the old grief arises, when the anger arises, okay, this is my chance to practice. And again, at times on longer retreats and so forth, it will just start, you know, old stuff will just start, you know, coming up, or new stuff. So it can happen in many different ways, but it will tend to happen for everybody in some way as we reconnect with all the parts of ourselves. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I mean, like, I never did sat down for 6 hours and went through it systematically like that. But certainly in a more hodgepodge, natural, unpredictable unfolding, mm-hmm. things that happen. So, yeah. Then, let's do Laura first. Yeah.
Well, two things. One is in relation to what I'm really glad that Nancy asked that question and what you said, because I was thinking when you said it, like, wow, I've never even gone on a long trip except when I was 25 and I freaked out. And does that mean I can't do this? And, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the article you wrote again, which I keep every time I see you. I ask, because I can't seem to really get at my question, which is, you know, how do you know it's just, yeah, it takes effort, so I'm going to direct myself to do it, to be there, or to come here.
Yeah.
And when is it, you know, you should be, and you've got to be more, and it just seems endless. That's one that just came up. And then my original question was, I work with children, and I find some of them prefer that they. I just do the connection with what that gentleman was saying. I'm just enraged so much of the time, and it's very confusing because my job is to direct their behavior and to be their teacher. So it's not like I can just really just sit back and say, do your thing. But on the other hand, what? It's just very difficult, and I run into it with my son also. What's the difference between being a teacher and being controlling, and why is there so much anger because they're not doing what I think they should be doing? It's confusing because I really can't just sit back. And anyway, that's all. what we're talking about here, and when I go to do my job every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you said a whole lot there. And actually, you know what, one thing, I'll comment on a couple of things you said, but, you know, it might be nice, and this is open to everybody here, you know, to meet individually sometime where we could talk about some of this at more specifically and more at length, and that might be helpful for you. But the first thing about the shoulds, that's part of the practice is getting to know a should when you see it, when it's there, versus a clear intention. Now, you might have both. You know, we often have both going on, and that's why it gets confusing. You might have a very clear and pure intention to come meditate, and then the should voice comes in and says, well, you really should do this, and you should do it more even, you know. And then as soon as the should voice comes up, I don't know about everybody else, but then I don't want to do it. So, because that voice is a, you know, it's an old childhood bossing you around voice, right? So the thing is to get to know, there again, meet the should, recognize the should. See if you can peel that apart. Feel the pure intention and feel the should. See if you can start to notice. Don't do anything with them. Just notice them and notice how they feel differently. I got so that I know, whenever, I don't even have to think the should. I can feel it's there in my body, you know. And so you get to be real familiar with the should. You meet the should with what? With kindness, with acceptance, with recognition. That's all, you know. And then the more you do that, you just see, there's that should. It doesn't have to, that's all it is. Now I want to go to my pure intention. But it takes time, you know, to tease those apart, and sometimes we get confused. But you're starting to do it. And so there's that. You know, with your classroom and the kids, and then again, the kindness, you can be very strong and very intense and very powerful, and yet be holding with a kind intention. So it's, again, you can be very directive. You need to be all those things. We need to be that with children or in other situations in our life and with ourselves to some degree. But with this kind, so it's this, what is your intention with these kids? You want them to be happy. You want them to learn. You want them to have a good life. You want them to be functional in their lives, right? That's really, you have a lot of, I'm sure you could say more. And that is really your intention behind, even when you need to stop them doing and in there driving you nuts and so forth. But what I would say first, when you're not feeling particularly kind towards them, bring kindness to that. Okay? Start there. So you need to really start with yourself. And when that's easier, it'll be easier with them.
That's sort of been happening naturally, just a tiny bit when I notice them and say,
yeah. Okay.
A little.
Yeah. And you know, even just reminding yourself, you know, what do I really want for them? And not about the specifics of, you know, I want them to clean up their shit, you know, whatever it is. But what do I really want for them? And why, and I'm here to
sometimes literally they will not be able to function in the world if they can't contain themselves.
Right.
That's a lot of what it's about.
That's right. Yeah.
And I can even sometimes directly say, right.
You might even write some of these down and have them on your desk, and you're going, oh man, these kids are making me crazy. I want them all to leave right now. And acknowledge that's how you feel, and then you might say, why am I here? Okay. You know?
Yeah.
And this is why. Okay, yeah, I remember. So good. Yeah. So, Bill, did you have a quote or something?
Yeah. It's the first time I've heard of the translation of Stocky, was really hard. It reminds me of translation also for attachment.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the Pali.
I don't remember the Pali either.
And the real meaning in English, you know, for attachment is clinging. Yeah. You know, you can get kind of off kilter and
yes.
process that.
Yeah.
It's always been a bit of a bugaboo for me.
Yes.
You know, you have to use language to communicate yeah. concepts. Why can't we start calling these things the right thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's right yeah. mind. I mean, that makes a whole big difference yeah. when you really think about it.
That's right. Yeah.
And experience it, because when you said that, I'm like, yeah, that's much more my experience. It's part of mine. It's not just mine.
Yeah.
So, start a revolution.
Yes.
Heart mind.
Yeah, maybe we can make that an English word, heart mind.
Heartful mindedness.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you say heartfulness?
Heartfulness, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there is a component of mind in the sense of bigger attention.
Yes.
You know, so that I feel that component, but then the feeling side of it, feeling yeah. presence, is also right. there. So, I like that, heart mind.
Good. Good. I think it's really important. So. And I do think the word attachment has problems.
Yeah. It's off in a different direction.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, well, thank you all for your presence and your thoughtful responses and being willing to come here on Sunday instead of Christmas shopping. So I have a few announcements, and then we'll close. Let's see. There will be no surprise, there'll be no sittings here on December 25th and January 1st. There in Ben Lomond, where I have my group, there will actually be no Monday night group on December 24th or 31st. There will be an event here on the 31st. I'll be leading a New Year's Eve peace meditation. Starts at 9:30 in the evening, goes to... We're going to finish about 12:15, and I'm suggesting people bring some snacks or, I don't know, sparkling cider. and we can stay for a while, but if the official part will be over about 12:15, and there'll be some a little bit of ritual and candle lighting and some chanting and meditating and so forth. So you're all welcome if you want an alternative to the other kinds of New Year's Eve. let's see, there's a beginner's class starting January 9th, Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 8:30 with Bruce and Jill Hyman for a week. So it's for beginners, it's for people who just want to review the instructions, it's for people who are kind of new to practice, but you know, anybody can come, in other words. Any other announcements? Okay, well, let's finish up with a little bit of more formal metta practice, although I don't do it all that formally. So, but just to end this time together, just relaxing and softening and creating space and openness. And just for a moment, seeing if you can have a sense of resting into that open, accepting container space of love and kindness and care and well-wishing. Although I said it's not a feeling, it sort of has a feeling quality. And that might be different for each of us. And begin by holding yourself within that. You know, in the Metta Sutta, it talks about radiating loving kindness. So you might even, I sometimes feel it as a force or an energy or, you know, whatever works. We're pretty flexible here. So if you sort of hold yourself within it or shine the light of to yourself, holding yourself with just kindness for all your sorrows and joys, the whole nature of your whole life. And then we have a little blast of that for yourself. Now include everyone here. allow your container to be big enough to include everyone here. All the joys and sorrows, mishaps, accomplishments of everyone here on this very imperfect, flawed human journey. And then let your container expand or let yourself radiate outward in all directions, however it works for you, to touch all beings everywhere, human and non-human, all directions. Just extending it outward. This great openness, acceptance, care, well-wishing. The wise intention of the Eightfold Path. Fueling this loving-kindness. This compassion, tenderness towards suffering. And so may we wish, may we have that sense that may all beings know real happiness. May all beings know the peace of the Buddha. And may all beings live with freedom. But have wonderful holidays, whatever you're doing, and enjoy yourself, whatever you're doing, and be kind to yourself, whatever you're doing. Yeah. Yes, yes. If you would stack the chairs, that'd be great. And also brush off your cushion, your mat, and your cushion to clean it off a bit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.